Welcome. This is Dr. Bill Blatchford. Welcome to Playing Your A-Game. Tonight we have Dr. Stephen Greenman from West Los Angeles on our call tonight. Playing Your A-Game, of course, is a book that we wrote a couple of years ago. We portrayed the practice of 23 offices. Actually, I see a couple of the doctors in the book are on the call tonight. We have about 80 people registered for this call tonight. The call will be recorded, and so all of you that are registered will receive a recording of this. I also want to mention to you that Carolyn and I put on a ski trip every year to Park City, Utah. We'll be going February 26th through March 4th this year. I'll be leaving Park City actually on the 3rd to go speak at the Pacific Dental Meeting in Vancouver, and then we're going to go speak in Whistler. But this is Dr. Stephen Greenman. Last summer, we did a salmon fishing trip with a group of doctors up on the British Columbia coast. Stephen doesn't usually look like this when he's in his dental office, but I wanted a photo today, and I had this great photo I took of him last summer. He cleans up pretty well, so he looks a little better in his office than he does. So tonight, what we want is Dr. Greenman to share his Blatchford journey with us. Dr. Greenman, are you there?
I'm here, Bill.
Very good. Before we start, I would like everyone to hit the *6 on your phone. We will have some questions. And if you have a question as we're going along, please hit your *6 and speak up, and we can hear your question. We'll have a period at the end also for questions and answers, and you can ask questions of Dr. Greenman or myself. I'm going to let him take most of the questions, I believe, probably all of them, unless they're specifically addressed at me. Before we start, I'd like to mention I have the list of the doctors in front of me who are on the call. I see several of our clients and past clients. Welcome for all of you. I see several of you that are repeats from before, and you've been thinking about this program for a long time. Last year we had, while you were thinking about this program, our roughly 50 clients that we take each year had an average of just a little over $100,000 increase in their net income, and they took, on the average, about 4 extra weeks of vacation. Some did less than that. I think our highest increase in net last year was $230,000 increase in net. And so while you were thinking about it, these doctors did that. So we're going to talk about that tonight. So Dr. Greenman, Stephen, tell us a little bit your Blatchford journey. You've been a client now for almost 5 years, we figured.
Yes, it's been...
Why don't you take us back to the beginning, what you were looking for, about your practice, where you practice, what you were looking for, what took place, where you are today.
Okay, Bill. Thank you. I'm Stephen Greenman, and I grew up in Los Angeles, and I've never really left the Los Angeles area. I attended UCLA, graduated in 1981.
Go Trojans.
You're Trojans? Okay, well, hang up. You got to get off the line right away.
Well, you're almost a Trojan. You took an IV course this year, Stephen.
That's true. I did. I did an IV sedation certification program, and I did it at USC with Stanley Malamud.
And you called me the first morning and said you were having a real difficult time even walking on the campus.
That's right. But, well... Actually, I think it was May, and school was still in session, and the dental school's right in between two of the major dorms, so it's actually quite pleasant to stand outside.
That's what
and
you
watch.
Also mentioned that.
I yeah, I like that part too. Yeah, that was good. So I do have close ties with USC. Actually, my mentor was Charlie Goldstein, who started the mobile clinic program at USC. So I do have a lot of affinity for that school as well, and a lot of friends that attended that are now faculty there. And I started practice right in the West L.A. area. That was back in 1981. In 1989, I moved to where I live now, which is Westlake Village, which is right on the Ventura County, L.A. County border, inland from the coast, maybe 15 miles inland from the coast. I started my journey with Blatchford about 5 years ago, although I had been with a number of different consultants over the years. In fact, before Bill, I don't think I had a consultant helping me for probably nearly 5 years. And I actually had been just turned off to the whole idea of having consultants, and I didn't really plan to ever do it again. I'd had three different consultants. There'd been some help, but I never really saw the kind of change and growth in my practice that I had wanted to. Along about 5 or 6 years ago, I was having a practice here real close to my house in a beautiful location. I had 8 employees. I had good numbers. I mean, I had enviable numbers. I believe I was around $800,000. And on the other side of the coin, I was barely netting maybe 30% if I was lucky. And after paying my taxes and then paying for my practice loan to get my this office set up and everything else, it was tight. It was tough. And here
and
I was.
And you had a little setback in setting up that office, too.
Well, prior to setting up this office, and this was actually when I was in West L.A., I had planned to set up this office back in 1995-96, but there was an earthquake in West L.A., actually it was in Northridge, 1994. My office, which was on the west side of L.A., the building was red-tagged, and we never were able to get back inside of it, and it was completely demolished within 5 days of the earthquake, and my practice was in there, and I had hoped to sell that practice and to be able to then transition myself out here full-time in Westlake Village, but I never got to. And the practice was about a $450,000 practice. Interestingly, it was a practice which, I'm glad I'm shed of it, to tell you the truth. I had HMOs, I had PPOs. I wasn't working it every day, but when I was there, I was on roller skates. And I don't even know if I was particularly, I was at least getting by with it. But after the earthquake, my options were to either open up a new office, go through all of that, or to go in with somebody else. And I decided to go in with somebody else, and the somebody else told me, in no uncertain terms, no HMOs. So I dropped it, not knowing what would be around the corner. And as it turned out, it was one of the better things that I did, because I then began to develop my practice in the way that I wanted it to. So I was working here in my Thousand Oaks office with this high overhead, a lot of staff working here. And I can remember several evenings trying to get that last procedure done, that last crown prep, whatever.
Okay. So now you were practicing, you were looking for something, and you had consultants who were trying to get you to outrun your overhead, basically.
Well, I was hoping they would get me to outrun my overhead, but they were also adding to my overhead. By the time I finished my last consultant, I had two people at the front desk. One was a hygiene consultant. I had maybe six or seven days of hygiene. That person's job was to keep the hygienist books full. I was really running ragged here in the office, and I was 45 or so, been in practice for 20 years, and starting to think that, gee, I'm never going to be able to retire if this sort of thing keeps up, because I'm not going to be financially independent anytime soon or ever if I don't do something. So I think that is what got me to thinking more about working with Bill Blatchford, and I had heard him on a few different occasions. And Bill's message of smaller staff, reduced overhead, and higher growth really was the kind of practice that I wanted. And so I probably spent about a year before I actually made the move to do this. So I decided, when I began talking to Bill a little bit and I started to really look at, what was this going to mean for me? I mean, the investment that I was going to have to make to go into the program was significant, very significant. As a matter of fact, my wife was just dead set against it, spending that kind of money, knowing that money was tight to begin with. But
are you still married, Stephen?
Well, I'm still married.
Same wife.
Same wife.
Yeah, and she's okay
married.
With it now.
Well, she's certainly okay with it. We are very comfortable. We're able to put our daughter through college with on our own cash flow. So all the money that I had been saving over the years, I still have it for her. So maybe it'll help her with a down payment on a house one day. And I've got nice retirement accounts. So obviously, they've taken a bit of a hit, but I can't touch them for 7.5 years anyway. So hopefully, they will come back. So yeah, I'm definitely still married. You know, she was negative on spending that kind of money, but when I looked at it from a business point of view, and just calculated the return on investment, it was going to be positive if I didn't even increase my growth at all, because I was looking at salary overheads that were above 30% in my practice.
What are you now?
Oh, I'm under 20% now.
And you've been under 20 for what, 4 or 5 years now?
Probably since 2 days after I finished signing up with the Blatcher program and having our summit meeting. I came right back to work, and I shed staff and cut overhead right away. I understood return on investment. I purchased a CEREC machine a couple of years before I started with Bill, and that's a significant investment. Some of you may have it. Some of you may be thinking about it. It's a $100,000 piece of equipment. But the return on investment for this piece of equipment was significant. My first year return was than $65,000 for purchasing this piece of equipment. Sure, you had to learn it, and it took a lot of work to incorporate it into the practice, but it sure was worth it. And so when
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
When you got ready to buy your CEREC, what was your wife's reaction to that?
Oh, she didn't think twice about purchasing expensive pieces of equipment for the office. My $100,000 CEREC. A few years later, I purchased a water lase from BioLase. I spent $50,000 on that. Really, no discussion about adding equipment. I think that the problem is my wife is real careful with how she spends our household budget, and when she saw that I was going to spend a lot of money to hire yet another consultant to help the practice, she didn't see that as being a positive at all. And I don't think she really understood the concept of return on investment. And when I put it to her, well, look, you know, even if this doesn't work and we don't have any more money coming in, we're still going to make half again as much on our initial investment.
Just on a reduction of overhead. Stephen, what is your overhead?
You
told us what you were doing and what you're doing now. What is your production and what is your overhead now? And in 2008 was not a great year economically in your area.
No.
How'd you do?
Well, the first year that we were with Dr. Blatchford, we were putting all of our systems in place, and I told you we were about 800,000 when we started. I think by the end of that first year, we'd bumped the practice up to about 900,000. But the good news was that I had cut my overhead from 70% down to 55%, and I was also working quite a bit less. I was taking 6 or 7 weeks vacation. I was working much saner hours. I was concentrating my production in the morning hours when I was feeling fresher. I wasn't doing large, complicated procedures when it was late in the day and getting dark. The next year, we went over $1 million, and we haven't looked back. We've been over $1 million every year since the second year with Bill,
including
and the overhead has stayed in the 55% range.
If you were to you know, doctors are always are interested. How did you lower your overhead? How did you go from a 70% overhead to 55 in a year, while your income went up? What are the steps? They want to know what the steps are that you did.
Well, step one is to take a real, and this was the hardest thing for me, was to take a real critical look at the staff that I had, who was doing what, and really deciding that if I didn't rate a 9 or a 10, they were just out. They were gone. I wasn't going to keep them. And that was the hardest part, was to reduce my staff. I also reduced the hygiene department, because hygiene was always a very expensive part of our practice, which I felt offered very little return and really was a headache for me, having to do if any of you are doing it, more than one hygiene check an hour. So I know a lot of guys are doing, 15, 16 a day. It just eats into your time so much.
One of the things that we looked at, of course, when I was practicing, I had some early soft tissue people in my office, and I had 10 days a week of hygiene. I was working 4 days, so Mondays and Tuesdays, I had 3 hygiene checks an hour. And one day I pointed out to my team, I said, if I do 5 minutes a day times 24, I said, bottom line is I'm spending so fewer hours doing dentistry. You see, if you're at 16 patients a day and you get stuck in it for 5 minutes, you're 2 hours a day. So if you get into 3 hours, my gosh, you're only doing dentistry 5 hours. And so we looked at this, and if I get stuck in it for 10 minutes, you can just do the math and see where you are. And my thing on this is, so many dental practices and so many consultants are trying to grow that hygiene department. And my belief is that most practices are over hygiene. That is, they have more hygiene capacity than they have demand. And they're like Ford Motor Company. Ford Motor Company can make more Ford trucks, but they can't sell them right now. And yet what I find is an inordinate amount of energy, that is, energy means dollars, spent trying to fill those last few hygiene visits, and that's a huge drain on practice.
Something that we had to really make some changes for. The other thing we did is we went from eight staff people. Not all were full time. I think that five of them were full time.
So what was that like to manage 5 full time and 3 part time members?
You can't manage that. It's impossible, because you cannot make a cohesive team out of people who are there part time, because communication suffers. Nobody really then understood my vision or what I was going through. It was sort of every man for himself, and really, the one who suffered the most was me, because I was taking all the risk. Something had to change.
How many staff do you have now?
We have 3 full-time staff, and we have a junior college student who wants to be a hygienist. She's taking her prereqs for hygiene, who mm-hmm. comes in the afternoons a few days a week. Her job is to get the office ready for the afternoon. The other way that we increased or reduced our overhead is that I began to really embrace the concept that that Blatchford taught me, block booking, where we book long procedures in our morning, and our goal is to meet 80% of our daily production goal by lunchtime. And it can be done. It requires, though, setting those blocks aside for that, and I make the decision how these blocks are going to be filled and the dollars per hour that they're going to require in order to fill them, and then keeping them available. And one thing that I just stopped being concerned about was seeing an open hole on my schedule in a couple of days, and I didn't panic, and I kept it available, because invariably we were able to fill it with much higher production procedures. So we were seeing fewer patients, higher dollars per hour per patient, and obviously a much lower staff overhead, because we had so many fewer people.
What is your staff? You have our bonus system in place. What do your staff members earn in bonus money?
Well, my bonuses, last year, staff bonus $16,000. That was split 3 ways. I have 3 staff, and between them, I believe that their income was about $187,000, $188,000. The year before, it was similar. It was about $15,000. The year before that, it was $21,000.
So that extra $5,000-$6,000 a year is, it doesn't sound like a lot of money to you doctors on the phone, but to team members who are earning $35,000-$40,000, and you'll notice it in Dr. Greenman's office, the average is about $60,000 a piece. Now, a hygienist in Los Angeles does quite well, but that's still, he has a receptionist who's very well paid. We have other offices who are We have. Last year, I had two receptionists in two separate offices that earned $100,000 apiece. And the question is, what kind of receptionist do you get for $100,000? Well, you get somebody who can manage $1.5 to $2 million practice by herself at the front. So this bonus system really does work, and it's a great motivator for people, and it's an integral part of our program. And yet, I don't want you to go home and reduce your staff down to 20%, because you have to put the systems in place. Stephen has mentioned block booking. That is one of the key areas right there. And one of the things that I find is that so many team members say, well, it won't work in our practice, and yet we've put that into literally hundreds of practices, and it does work. He's also mentioned selling larger cases. So what have you done to sell larger cases in your practice?
Well, I think there are two prongs with selling larger cases. Number one, I believe, is to become more diversified in what your offerings are, i.e., getting and pursuing high-quality continuing education so that you can add services to your practice that make it so that you can provide a long, comprehensive appointment. For example, about around the time I started with Bill, I became interested in placing my own implants. And so there's many times where we'll do a long procedure for a particular patient, and it might include several units of crown and bridge, plus implant placements, plus fixture-level impressions of the implants, and then temporaries, and then my next appointment with the patient really is when I'm starting to deliver all of the work. So it can be very profitable, but it's important to have it on the shelf, so that you can't sell it if you don't have it on the shelf. And so that means becoming adept at modern procedures that patients want, and people do want dental implants.
One of the things that we started to promote with our clients about 4 years ago was to diversify. We were finding that marketing the cosmetic practice was becoming more and more difficult because cosmetics had become the standard of care, and everybody wanted to be the cosmetic dentist. And at AECD, which I'll be speaking at again, and I'm actually kind of surprised they let me come back to their meeting, because about 4 years ago I said in my lecture at AECD, I said, how many cosmetic dentists does your community need? And the rhetorical question of my answer was about half as many as they have. And so we've been encouraging doctors to diversify, and Stephen places implants. He does IV sedation. He does sleep apnea. And these are areas that, of course, you have to learn how to sell these items, but it really is critical. As far as the cost of our program, I put a slide up for those of you who are on the computer. Our cost is exactly the same as a $17 an hour dental assistant, and that is calculated at 38 hours a week, 48 hours, or 48 weeks out of the year. So I just thought I'd throw that out there. Go ahead. Stephen, what are some of the other systems you put in place that have really made it possible to operate here at a 55% overhead and still take the time off and still have the money available to take all these courses? Because you've taken a lot of courses since we started to work together.
Well, yes, I have, and I used to think that I did a lot of continuing ed, but it was really one-day courses, evening courses. I would amass plenty of hours, way more than was required, but I really didn't do it in a comprehensive fashion. So I mentioned block booking. I also mentioned, training for my team and learning how to and having every team member really learning how to sell and learning that selling is not a negative word. It's not a dirty word. What it really is finding out what your client, your patient really wants, learning to ask questions about that, really getting to the nitty-gritty of what they want, and then asking them if they want to proceed. It's really that simple. However, it takes a lot of work to learn how to do it. I think that's the other system that we put into place. We've also put in cross training. Our team is cross trained to do just about anything that
they
can get a
license for. A little bit, because I think that's a system that I think that's kind of unique to what we teach. I don't think there are too many other consultants, if there are any others, who teach that hygienists, for example, can collect money in the treatment room. Who can make, a lot of them make their next appointment, but how many of them actually collect the money? How many of them produce an insurance form on the spot? How many of them are comfortable talking about money? I think that's a big part.
Well, there are systems now, because of automation, that one can have the equivalent of a hygiene coordinator, but be able to purchase that for a couple $100 a month, and I'm talking about companies like Smile Reminders,
yes,
or what have you, that allow you to contact your entire database via texting and email and communicating whatever you want to communicate to them with really just the touch of a button. You can make these nice little e-newsletters that we send out all the time. Also, we've been able to eliminate having to confirm hygiene. We do not confirm hygiene anymore because of Smile Reminders and because our hygienist makes her own appointments, and when she makes an appointment for somebody for 6 months from now, she has a script that she goes through in a conversation about how important that appointment is, and that we don't send out reminders, although since we have your email, you will get an email. And we've cut down on no-shows it's way under 10%.
One of the things I'd like all of you to look at, one of the things that we think is important is the overhead per hour that it costs to operate your office. And this is something all my clients know, and for those of you clients on the phone that are on this call tonight, every one of them knows their cost per hour. And every team member knows their cost per hour. And one of the things that we have discovered, and it's always a shock to people to find this out, is the cost per hour does not include your lab bill. So once you pull out the lab, the cost per hour for hygiene is the same as it is for the doctor. And if you have one cancellation, one no-show per day, your hygiene department runs in the red. And so as Stephen is saying, one of the things to do is to titrate that hygiene department down to so the capacity equals the demand you have, and then not to have cancellations. And it is critical for your net income to titrate it to where you're actually, where capacity equals demand, and then not have cancellations. Stephen, anything else on systems you've put in place? Talk a bit more about the sales, training your team to sell dentistry.
Well, what we have done, what we do is we practice communication, how to talk to people, what questions to ask. We've distilled it down so that at each telephone station there's a pad so that if a new patient calls, and we have a list of questions that we go through, and the questions are designed to be open-ended and to facilitate really finding out what a person wants. I can remember just being completely flummoxed when a patient would call up and say, "How much is a crown?" And the team would go, and they wouldn't know what to say, or they would put the person on hold and come and ask me when they knew full well how much the crown cost.
If I
they didn't know what to do.
Doctors?
Yes.
Doctors, everybody doctor on the call. Telephone conversations are critical. And if you are not training your team how to answer the phone, I'll just share with you that they're probably not very effective. My two consultants called 100 offices about 2 months ago. Over 90% of those offices did not even ask the patient to make the appointment. We called with a very specific request. What does it cost to do a crown in your office? About 70% would not tell us. Now, there's a conventional wisdom out there that says that if a patient asks how much, they're not a good patient. But that is baloney. I want you to think about an area where you know nothing about, and you walk into a shop or you call somebody on the phone. What is the first question you ask? How much does it cost to fill in the blank? That's a typical question. And yet what I find is that 90% or more of dental office receptionists do not know how to effectively handle that call?
Well,
it's just a matter of script.
That is the essence of selling, right there, and it's practice. We practice it. We practice it over and over again. We make up a scenario, and we sit here in our team meetings, and we practice a call. And if there was a particularly difficult call, we would make sure that we noted it, so that then when we came back together again, one of us could pretend to be that difficult caller.
And let me ask you a question.
Practice it.
In 2008 and 2009, what we're seeing is we have our leader telling us that the recession is going to be deeper before it gets better. The times are tough. We know that retail sales are down. We know that there's an unemployment problem in our country, although right now we're not quite at 10% unemployment, but remember that 5% is normal. So, yes, we have 5% more people unemployed right now than normal. Sales are more difficult. Restaurants are closing. Retail stores are closing for lack of sales. Sales are down. Stephen, in your practice, how have you prevented or how have you not had a decrease in sales? I mean, 08 was a great year for you.
Yes, 08 was a good year, and I believe it's because we added another service. We added IV sedation, and I fully believe that, and then looking at the numbers prove it out, that it made our fourth quarter one of our best quarters of the year, and it propelled us over the $1 million mark again, like in 08 and 07.
And of course, you had to sell that service as well.
Yes, you do have to sell that service. There are great books that you can read, that your team should read along with you, and to teach you how to sell. One good book is called Integrity Selling. I think that was one that really stuck with me over the years, because it really made me understand how selling is a noble profession, and that selling does not connote going into an automobile dealership and having your arm twisted until you want to kill yourself.
How much time have we spent with you on case presenting? We have 4 days of seminar. How much time have you as a team spent on sales skills?
Well, once a month we have a training session that lasts for a half a day. I would say on that training session, at least 25 to 50% of it is spent on sales training. We read about a book every month or so, and that involves either selling or communicating or interacting with people. It has nothing to do with dentistry. It's all about the human touch and connecting with people. Mm-hmm. So at our weekly meetings, which last about an hour, we will spend about 15 minutes on sales training, and it's role-playing, okay? And it felt like acting at first. I mean, it felt phony even to me at first, until I practiced it enough where it started to feel comfortable. And then when I started to ask these questions, I would find out things about my patients that I never, ever knew before, even with my existing patients, that were just astounding, and also helped to help them to see that they wanted to move on, to take the next step. And there's just some powerful questions that we learned how to ask people.
Stephen, if I hadn't been pushing you, holding your feet to the fire,
yeah,
would you have asked those questions repeatedly until you got comfortable with them?
I'm the kind of person where if I'm going to invest the amount of money that I did to do the Blatchford program, I mean, I'm not going to screw it up. And
right.
So this was a strong motivator, just spending the money, and then having the feedback and the constant asking me, well, you know, what have you done to learn how to sell better from Bill on every single conference call, every coaching call, has been very important, and we still get it. I've been a client for 5 years. I guess I'm in the graduate program, and it's called the Connection Program. And there's a monthly fee that I pay gladly to be a part of this Connection Program. I'm not getting any breaks for this call or anything like that. Where Bill does put us all on the spot and ask us, well, you know, what are you doing to make this particular part of your practice go? So it's ongoing, and you're held accountable, just like you need to hold your own team accountable for the what you want them to do, the progress you want them to make, the changes that you want them to make. You have to, as the client, you have to be willing to look, take a hard look at yourself as well as them, and I think I made changes in how I did things. Big changes.
Let's open this up to questions. Doctors, if you have questions, you'll have to hit the *6. It takes a few moments for it to take effect. You must have some questions for Dr. Greenman. Ask him anything you want. I mean, don't pull any punches here. Just ask questions. Some of you doctors have been on several calls and have been looking at this program for some time. Here's your chance. Pose your questions.
What is your current makeup of your team?
Current makeup of your team. Who is the question here from?
Clinical assistants, Dr. Bill Myers, works
on the Well, the current makeup is we have one practice administrator named Rachel Croner, and we have a full-time dental hygienist. Her name is Kara Hedlund, and we have a full-time chairside assistant named Nana Villegas, and then we have a part-time person who comes in the afternoons. Her name is Vivian Linares, and Vivian
tell us the background of Rachel. I think that's kind of interesting.
Well, we'd gone through this is one thing, and that I'm going to tell you right now that was the hardest for me is, and I think one of the toughest journeys was to really understand how to attract and get the right type of people that can share your vision and be part of your team. Rachel came from the local Hyatt Hotel. We were looking to make a change at our front, our administrative position, and my wife gave me the brilliant idea, why don't you put on your big boy suit, put some cards in your pocket, and go to the hotel. So I went to the Hyatt, which is local, and there's a Four Seasons local. And I got Rachel's resume, probably was in my email inbox before I got home. And so we knew she really wanted the job, and that's how we found her. She had no dental background. In fact, she's almost a dental phobic, I would say. Okay. But she has overcome enough of her fears where she participated in the IV sedation program. She did venipuncture. She does help me. She has an X-ray license now. And she knows how to communicate with people.
So when we teach cross training, we really mean cross training. That means that everyone learns how to do everything the law will require them to do. And in this case, Rachel had a background in the hotel business, in the customer service business, and a drama major in college. And she had to learn how to take X-rays. She had to learn how to do these things. And when Stephen went through his IV training, she had to learn how to do these things, and it was an interesting journey for her, but she has grown immensely and grown into an incredible receptionist. Very good. So it's three and a half people. Other questions? Other questions for Dr. Greenman? Speak up.
I have a question about the CEREC. You mentioned you incorporated the CEREC into your practice. How was that as far as the learning curve and how it changed your way of doing dentistry in the sense that you're doing more in-office restorations versus sending that out?
Can I take that for just a second? I'm a supporter of CEREC as long as you're doing about $1 million a year. You have to do the math. Are you doing enough units of Crown and Bridge, and be honest with yourself to make it pay? And are you willing to spend the time, the learning curve of learning how to do it efficiently?
And that's one of my concerns too. We are a very high. We're probably the opposite of kind of where you guys, you know, kind of what this seminar is about. I'm at about a $2.2 to $2.4 million practice, very high overhead. three doctors. I am the only owner, and I am looking at bringing another partner in. And actually, I'm planning on
growing my practice.
You need
to talk to us first. First off, is that 2.2 per doctor?
No, it's total for the
total?
Practice.
Then that's not a high-volume practice. That's actually
right.
A low-volume practice. It's just
considering
you have so
all
many
of
doctors.
Us, right.
And so what you guys are doing is you have a huge capacity to produce dentistry, but you have not developed a demand to match your capacity. With three doctors, I'm going to tell you, we have single doctors doing that kind of production.
That's pretty amazing.
With a very small staff. We have a doctor that, the 2 million, one, right at 2 million seems to be a break-off point for one doctor. I have worked with a few doctors doing in excess of that. If you read our A-book, one of the doctors in the playing your A-game did just at $3 million, one doctor, four staff members.
I being the main provider and producer here and my associates being part-time, I think if I were to incorporate my hygiene program myself, I am probably doing about 1.5 to 1.7 altogether, including hygiene.
And my question there would be, why all these other people involved? Because we could take that practice and turn it into 50% overhead.
That's why I'm listening tonight.
Very good. Make sure one of our representatives, what is your name? Well, you don't have to tell us that. Usually, don't tell us your name now.
I'll do it online or later on.
Overhead, and I'm sure you've heard this before, but I did it. A $800,000 practice, 30% overhead, that's a $240,000 net. You know, that same practice with the overhead 10% less, I mean, think that's another $80,000 worth of net. So overhead is our single biggest hurdle here. I mean, it's a killer.
I agree with you. I'm operating probably well over 70%. If anything, my overhead is probably increased over the past year because we just built a brand new facility with more operatories and all new equipment because we were stuck in the 60s with our old technology and equipment.
Exactly.
So we hopped across about 50 years in dental technology, but I also increased my overhead probably, by a good 15 to 20%. So I'm working harder, I'm working more days, I have less, I'm sleeping less, I'm stressed out a lot more.
Well,
and I am interested to see what how you've been able to reduce overhead, but I will be really honest with you, I love my team, and I went through a complete team transition last year, and I have done kind of what you talked about, evaluating are they your A group or A team, and I have a lot of A team members on the team, and I am interested in reducing my overhead, but I don't want to get rid of my team.
Well, the thing you want to think about is that it's not always a matter of getting rid of the team, but why does it take so many people to produce that much dentistry? That's the question you need to go to bed tonight thinking about.
Right.
Why does it take so many people to produce that amount of dentistry? I can tell you that I recently spoke with a dentist in California who I worked with several years ago, who himself and a team of five, now they brought in an associate last year, and they did 2.9 last year.
Oh, my God.
Amazing.
And that is, that's very doable. And why does it take so many people? And then again, I guess the question I would ask is, and you don't have to answer that tonight, but you should go to bed thinking about this, why does it take so many people to produce this dentistry? Why is it not possible for me to take home 45% of what I'm doing? And that practice did 2.9, had a $1.2 million net. So
okay.
Those are things you want to be thinking about.
For all
why does it take so many people? But you don't always have to get rid of people, but you can train those people how to become more efficient. How do we increase the demand? And a lot of that is sales training, how to sell the bigger case, because with that many dentists, you're producing well, but your associates aren't producing much. So anyway, good question.
It is a good question, and I think one of the part of my journey was the finally coming to the realization that my responsibility, number one, end of report, was to myself and my family, and we developed a mission vision statement that reflected that. And once I had that in place, I was able to use that as my guiding light when it came to making some of these tough decisions about people that I liked.
See, one of the things that we do is we believe that the leadership of the doctor is number one. And the number one thing on leadership is, what is my vision? What am I really trying to accomplish here? And I had a doctor a few years ago that, and Stephen has heard this before, but I went through the exercise on vision and where are we headed, what are we doing this for, and I had a doctor who, when he got clear on this, who had been in a very large practice, large overhead, lots of staff members, and he finally said, this ain't the Red Cross. And once he finally figured that out, he kept some very highly trained people. He kept the top people in his practice, the top staff members, and they did extremely well. But he had, again, too many. So that's a great question. That's a whole other concept, and I'd love to talk to you about that individually about that. Other questions, other doctors?
Stephen.
Yes.
Hello?
Hello?
This is Dr. Michael Collier.
Hello, Mike.
How you doing?
Fine.
Listen, on the integrity selling, what is the source of that book?
That is Ron Willingham.
Thank you, Willingham. I've seen it, but I haven't gotten it. Okay. I got a couple other things I'd like to touch on real quickly. Do you have a website?
Yes, I do.
What is that?
It's www.drgreenman.com.
Okay. On your advertising, what do you use? What formats do you use? And what do you what is your expense as far as percentage of your production? Do you tie to the advertising?
The advertising?
Yes. Yeah, so what do you find the most effective?
Okay. Well, I was old school, and I did absolutely zero advertising until about the time that I signed on with Bill. So it's only been about 5 years. I started out with a very simple website, and I believe that within a month of getting that website up and getting it listed on a, this was with Einstein, it's called Dental Doc Shop, I got a $24,000 case that came all the way from Australia. He actually lives here, but long story short, I got a great case, and I said, hey, this is just amazing. So I began to, I would say that my best advertising and the best bang for the buck is by far the website, and it's not just having the website. You've got to have it optimized so that the search engines find it. So,
Stephen,
and that's part of it. You just can't do it yourself.
What percentage do you spend on marketing?
Yes. The percentage, I would say that I'm spending around 7% or so of my gross on marketing.
And you want to remember, Stephen's in a very large metropolitan area, Los Angeles.
It's very competitive here. Yeah. I mean,
media is very expensive there.
Right.
You're Oakwood, Georgia. What's the population? Is that part of Atlanta or is that a small town?
It's north.
Okay, so you're not part of Atlanta?
No, we're part of the metro area, 40 miles from downtown Atlanta, actually.
Mm-hmm. So I'm in a
40,000 square foot dental bill, or not dental, but I'm in a 40,000 square foot building, and there are six other dentists in here besides me.
Very good. Other questions?
Could I ask one more quick question?
Yes.
Sure.
How do you calculate your staff bonuses? Is that a...
Well, they're calculated based on our funds or our income that's allocated for salaries, and that number is 20%. And now it's not just 20% of gross; it's 20%. Well, it's 20% of gross with the other expenses added on. So, in other words, if a person's salary is $20,000. Don't forget, you're going to be spending, you could spend up to another 15 to 18% on top of that when you take into account your share of Social Security, workman's comp, if you've got
medical
profit
insurance.
Sharing plan, you know, all of that. So what we do is that we share, after we hit our number, which is where our staff overhead is 20%, any dollar that we get above and beyond that, 20% of it goes to our team. And then it gets averaged so that I don't get hurt if, let's say, they have a really good month and then a really crappy month. So it's done in a way where it's fair to both sides. And they seem to be very satisfied with it. And part of the Blatchford program is the spreadsheet so that you can plug these
Michael, if
in.
You're interested in that bonus plan, just email my office and they'll be happy to send you the guidelines on the bonus plan. But that's a big
really
part
works.
Of motivating the staff.
Yeah. It does. It does definitely work because they look at the numbers every single day and they say, "Gee, you know, we need $5,000 on Friday, and then we're in our bonus situation, and we've got, you know, 4 more days to work this month." So they definitely get the picture, and they are strongly motivated by it.
Great.
Other questions? I have several clients on the phone tonight. Would you like to add any comments to what Dr. Greenman has said, or questions for him?
Bill, this is Carol.
Yes.
I actually am an employee of Bill's, but I was just thinking about how you teach the attrition factor for the doctor that was really having a hard time thinking about letting employees that go that are 10.
Well, that's a good question, and here's something for you to think about. We find that almost all offices are overstaffed. Now, there are two ways to deal with that, and listen, I've dealt with this for 20 years, and one of the ways you can do it is you can do what Stephen did, and you can go back, and he realized in his case, and we have a very, I think, an interesting evaluation system. I've never met these people, so I don't evaluate them, but we give them some criteria, and you evaluate them, and he went back and actually reduced his staff. We have other doctors, like, I will tell you a very good story for the doctor who was very concerned about reducing staff. My college roommate, and his name is Dr. Jeff Nemitz, and he's in Seattle. He's now retired. And he reduced his staff by 50% during the 2-year period that I worked with him. He never let a single person go. But here's what happens in so many offices, Carol, and you've seen this, you've been in dentistry a long time, that people move. They move to different cities. They become pregnant. They have babies, and they choose not to come back to work. All kinds of things occur. And what Jeff did, it took him a little bit longer to accomplish the size he wanted, but he never let a single person go. And it took about a year, and about a year later, he just, you know, people would leave. He just would not rehire. So there's a lot of ways to handle staff reduction. Besides just going home and getting out the chainsaw. You know, that's not something we have to do very often. Carol, does that answer your question?
Yes, absolutely.
But there are a lot of ways to do that.
Right.
Other questions from doctors or anybody else on the call? Questions or comments?
Dr. Greenman?
Yes.
Dr. Greenman, how do you train a staff that doesn't have any dental backgrounds? Like, because I'm about to hire somebody who is new to dentistry. So,
well, the good news about hiring somebody new to dentistry is they have no bad habits. You see, if I could take, I'm gonna answer this question. This is Bill speaking, not Stephen. If I could have my choice of people with no dental background for the front office, for example,
mm-hmm.
or someone with 20 years of experience,
mm-hmm.
see, my belief is you hire for attitude.
Okay.
You don't hire for skill, you hire for attitude, because I can train them the skills. What I find we do is that so many people have this, they have an attitude, I want flexibility, I want curiosity, I want willing to learn new skills, learn new things. And I ask the question very often in seminars with team members present, I say, do you have 20 years experience, or do you have 4 or 5 years, and now you've repeated it 15 more times? In other words, what new skill did you bring to the job last year? And what I find very often is there has been no skill added. I ask the question very frequently, what's the last good business book you read? And I get the look on faces of these team members like, what are you talking about, read a book? You know, our daughter, my wife and I have a daughter who's 37 who's going to graduate from dental school in June.
Mm-hmm.
She has 2 other bachelor's degrees before she decided to go back to dental school. Her first degree was in fashion merchandising, and she went to work at Nordstrom.
Mm-hmm.
And at Nordstrom, you know, they don't have any training programs.
Oh,
they
yeah.
put them on the floor, and the average new hired person lasts 4 days. During the year that she was there, she read 9 separate books on sales, went through 2 video sales courses, and she and I would write scripts. Now, you're ranked every single month based on your sales measured in American dollars. And she went from number 9 to number 2 in her department before she had to go back and get her second degree. But the point is this. I will very often start in seminars and I'll say, oh, so how many have read 9 books in your career? And I get very few hands. 9 books on sales.
9 books on sales.
and I get about 50% of the room have never read a book on sales. So I'd rather take somebody like Rachel, who knows nothing and says, I know nothing, train me, than to take somebody who's been at it 20 years and pretty much knows how to do this, you see. There's a young lady in our program, and I noticed that her brother-in-law, Brian Ulitsky, is on the phone tonight. Brian's a client of ours that I actually interviewed on one of these calls. His sister-in-law, Colleen Ulitsky, joined my program 8 months before they started their practice. I asked that very same question, and she's going to be in a new book that my wife has just took the printer today called Blatchford Blueprints. It's a study of 23 offices, and one of the photos that Colleen sent in was a picture of her and her 250 books on sales and business she has read in the last 3 years. So part of it is, it's a pretty simple business, but you have to train them on the people skills and the sales skills. Good question. Other questions? We have time for about two more questions.
Bill, what type of format can we expect at the ski event in Salt Lake City there at Park City?
Well, you can expect to get a lot of skiing, a lot of good times, and a very informal seminar. We're going to have breakfast together. We'll have lunch together probably on the mountain, and maybe at the end of the day we might spend a couple hours. Mostly skiing.
Okay.
I promise that this year I will not. Last year I broke my back in the Olympic bobsled run in Park City. I'm not going to do that this year. But we're going to get a lot of skiing. As a matter of fact, I skied this afternoon.
And is it appropriate to bring, you know, P&Ls and go over number type stuff?
Sure. I'd be happy to do that.
Okay.
Be happy to do that. It's a very informal. You make your own reservations. We do not have a block of rooms, but we have a great time. We actually have a doctor in Park City, Kent Johnson, who was a client. We helped him move there a few years ago. He works 3 days a week, unless it's fresh powder. Has a very small staff, does very well in his practice, limits himself to a limited number of patients for full mouth reconstruction and cosmetics, and that was something we helped him accomplish. So,
How do you see the sales of large cases, say 10,000 above, affected by the economic state?
You know, we have not seen that much effect at all. Our clients last year, for the most part, had record years, and I was reminded today of a story of a young man who's 29 years old who joined our program about 90 days ago. He bought a practice, 25 years old. January was his biggest month in the history of that practice. But we have many doctors who last year had record years, and that's continuing right on and through January. We had many doctors in January have record months, and they're selling large cases. You want to remember, there are still 90% of Americans who are working. It's true we have almost a 10% unemployment rate, but you know, 5% is normal. So we have another 5%. This unemployment is not even as close to what it was in 1980, 81, when interest rates for mortgages hit 20%. I think our newspapers are spending a fair amount of time trying to convince us how bad this is. And one of the things that I'm coaching doctors on to is not to take part in this recession.
We had, this is Steve again, we had a person having Bright Smile today, and invariably they want to watch television. And what do they invariably choose to watch? CNN.
Yeah.
So, you know, we try to just limit it to their room and try to have other sounds coming out everywhere else, because you just don't want to see that stuff.
I will tell you a secret here for everybody on the call. I have a client I was talking to on Monday that said they are now telling their clients that they have discontinued their cable and the television is not available. The only thing they have available now is the Smile Channel.
That would be okay, too. And you know, people are walking in the office, and they do expect to spend money, and they do want something when they walk in. So maybe they're not going to buy $20,000 from you today. Maybe they'll buy $6,500 from you, but they'll still be in your practice, and you've planted the seed.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think that just being positive and giving them what they want and asking them the questions are really what it's all about. And you just got to keep doing it, and you've got to be positive, and you may get rejection, but that's part of learning how to sell as well. Okay?
People are still spending money. Are they going to spend it in your office, I think, is the question. Or are they going to spend it someplace else where the people are being more proactive on their sales training?
And
I practiced throughout the recession of 80, 81, the recession of 87. As a matter of fact, in 85,
was the first year we hit $1 million in production. We doubled the size of my practice in 1981, and that was right in the middle in Oregon. We were a timber state, and unemployment was about 20% here. Mortgage interest hit 20%. People in California quit building homes, and we doubled our practice. And we simply chose not to participate in that recession. And part of it was learn how to ask the questions and show the value of treatment. Well, Stephen, I want to thank you very much for your time tonight.
You're welcome.
And if any of the doctors have other questions you'd like to call me, please send me an email, contact on our website, and any questions you have, we will have a representative call each one of you. My request is that you actually take that call or alert your receptions the fact that we will be calling and spend a few moments with our representative so that you can determine if this is the right thing for you. And the thing that I point out is that, you know, you can either be proactive about this, what's going on in the economy right now, or you can procrastinate. And I will assure you that your competitors are being proactive because they are trying to maintain their businesses. And one of the things that I always point out to doctors and to people, I'm a positive person, and one of the things that a coach that I worked with a number of years ago pointed out is that whenever something happens good in your life, you said yes to something. And one of the things that I have found is that people who, or when I'm speaking personally, when I don't say yes, I'm really saying no. And when I say no, nothing else happens except what's going on currently. And if I want an improvement, I have to say yes to something. So I always tell people to, you know, experiment for the next 30 days. No matter what someone asks you to do, the answer is yes. But it's amazing what happens when we start making decisions. If we just wait and remembering that no decision is a decision itself. And so I thank you for all being on this call tonight. Take the call from our representative when they call you and see if this program's for you. Dr. Greenman, thank you very much for your time tonight.
Oh, thanks, Bill.